Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it comes to federal food policy, there are several factors at play. Congress and agencies, such as the Department of Agriculture, help shape food regulations. But the food producers also influence what ends up on the grocery store shelf and what's available at the school cafeteria. Joining us now by phone is New York University professor of nutrition, food politics, and public health, and the author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, Dr. Marian Nessel. Welcome to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Forbes magazine named you as the second most powerful foodie in America behind First Lady Michelle Obama. What has Michelle Obama's impact been on the nation's food system?
Well, I actually think it's extraordinary, but not in ways that can be measured very easily. For one thing, she's raised the profile of the issue that she's devoted herself to, which is trying to reduce childhood obesity within a generation. That issue is now on the public agenda. Everybody knows about it. And some of the things that she's done have really gotten an enormous amount of publicity, trying to get kids more active, fixing what's going on in schools. And to the extent that she's working on issues that aren't controversial, those are going okay. The ones that are controversial are getting a lot of pushback right now.
The pushback comes from all different sectors of society, not just the politicos and the policymakers and the lobbyists and so forth in Washington, but you hear people critical of Michelle Obama all over the place, whether it's Facebook, you know, any kind of social media, that kind of a thing. Where is all of that coming from? Why, when it comes to Americans and their relationship with food?
Well, I think it's coming from a lot of places, and some of them don't have anything to do with food. They have to do with general anti-government sentiments. I can't help that think that racism is a part of it. But the food issues have to do with people really not understanding what's going on in schools, I think. I think there's a tremendous misunderstanding of what the government's role has been and is in trying to promote healthier diets for kids. I would say that the government has a role in trying to promote healthier diets for kids because the government picks up the health care expenses. Taxpayers pick up the health care expenses. And the government has always been involved in school food since it started. These are tweakings. The new rules are tweakings of rules that have been around for a long time. And throughout the country, most schools are managing to handle them quite well, particularly the schools that started earlier, knowing that this was coming, and in schools that have a real commitment to trying to keep kids healthy, this stuff is working just fine.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest this segment is Dr. Marian Nessel. She's a well-known food nutritionist. She's written the book Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. If you have a question or comment for her, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So when it comes to food policy in Washington, who are the main players these days, and has that changed much over time?
No, I think the main players have always been the same. What's different, that is, the food industry has always opposed any kind of regulation that would keep the products that they make out of schools. And that's certainly what's happening now. If you're a soda maker and your products have a lot of sugar in them, they're not going to be allowed in schools under the new rules. What's interesting about this particular political battle is that the School Nutrition Association, which is the organization that represents the people who actually cook the food, if they're cooking it, or serve the food, has come out strongly opposed to the new regulations. They want delays. They want changes. They complain about the difficulty that they're having. And some of, you know, many of their complaints have grains of truth in them and need to be taken seriously. And the Department of Agriculture is taking those seriously. But what makes the situation so difficult is that so much of the funding for the School Nutrition Association comes from the food companies who are affected by the new regulations. And this sets up a conflict of interest that puts the School Nutrition Association in a very, very awkward position.
I'm trying to figure out if the School Nutrition Association represents the schools that are providing the meals or who exactly it represents.
They represent the people who cook the meals and who serve the meals, the lunch ladies. That's the term that's sort of sometimes used. And the organization is deeply divided now. Mm-hmm. 19 former presidents of the School Nutrition Association have come out against doing anything to change the rules. They say give the rules a chance. They're working in plenty of places, and there really shouldn't be any changes. And so the organization itself is divided. And, you know, from my own personal experience going to schools and visiting, it's just remarkably personal. I can go into schools where the staff is just deeply committed to making sure that kids are healthy and happy and like the food and are eating it, and guess what? The kids are. On the other hand, I can go into schools where nobody seems to care very much and they're just going through the motions, mm-hmm. and the kids are throwing the food away. And it's just hard to explain how personal it is. So you can make all the rules you want, but if the individuals who are either cooking or serving, and many schools can't cook because they don't have kitchen equipment, if you go into these schools and see, it's just so personal. You can talk to the principal and know in a second whether the kids are going to be eating the food or not, by the attitude of the principal as to whether the lunches are important or not. If the schools consider the lunch program to be important, somehow it works, and they make it work even with all of the difficulties that are thrown in their way through bureaucracy and not enough money and all of the very real problems that school meals face.
Is there any geographic correlation to the split in the School Nutrition Association over this issue?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer.
Are there any demographics? I mean, you said some districts were already ahead of the game. Those are probably, I would imagine, wealthier districts that have the flexibility to do that.
I'm not sure that they are. Okay. I've been to some of the poorest schools in New York City, schools in neighborhoods that are basically totally low-income minority. And you walk into the school cafeteria and the food smells good. You're just so happy to be there because it smells delicious. You know, what's cooking today?
Mm-hmm.
The school food service staff know the names of the kids and interact with the kids around the food. Oh, you're going to love what I made for you today. And the kids are eating it, and the plate waste isn't ridiculous. On the other hand, I've been to other schools in New York City where that's not the case at all. I think it's on a school basis, not on a school district basis. It depends on who's there.
Is part of the law educating children about food?
Yeah, there's an education component in there as part of the Wellness Act, but that also varies very, very much by district and by school.
You know, at the time, the School Nutrition Association, which represents school nutritionists, they were on board with the Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids Act. What's changed?
This is a big change for them. And, you know, it's a big reversal of their attitude. I think legitimately some of the change comes from genuine problems that some schools are facing. And I cannot help but think that some of the other change is induced by the food companies who pay for practically half of the budget for the School Nutrition Association, pay for their annual meetings, mm-hmm. and are in there lobbying all the time.
Helen in Cleveland, you're on the air with Dr. Marion Nessel. Hi, Helen.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment that echoes what your speaker is stating. I am a registered dietitian and a food law attorney in Cleveland, and I work with food manufacturers that prepare meals and for the schools. And it's been my experience that really taking gentle approach to these changes, providing education, encouragement, and education to the children as well as the school staff really helped the children embrace the changes and accept some of these new foods. And I have attended some of these SNA meetings, and my experience has been Many of the members, these changes were difficult for them to understand, difficult for them to put into place, that I felt that the SNA members needed education themselves to implement some of these changes. Not all of them are registered dietitians, so it was difficult for them to make these changes acceptable.
Hmm. Okay. Helen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I would say one of the things that that the SNA, the School Nutrition Association, is doing that I think is really not helpful at all is it's lobbying its members to object to the regulations and call for them to be delayed or eliminated. And I don't think the organization should be doing that. I think it should be educating its members, just as the last caller said. It should be educating its members and teaching them why it's so important to be adhering to these standards.
The latest plan to roll back the 2010 law isn't the first. In 2011, Congress moved to classify pizza as a vegetable in school lunches. Can you tell us how that happened?
Oh, yes. It's one of the most dismal aspects of American politics right now. So two of the companies that were actually the main company that provides pizza for school meals didn't like the rules because its products would have had to change, and they didn't want to bother. So they went, they just did a bypass. They went straight to Congress and complained to Congress that these rules were going to affect them, and got Congress to put into an Appropriations Act, sneak into an Appropriations Act, a codicil that said that the Department of Agriculture could make no regulation with respect to the volume of tomato sauce that would count as a vegetable if put on pizza. So the result of that was that even a tablespoon of tomato sauce counts as a vegetable in the Department of Agriculture's way of counting vegetable servings. And the Maine potato lobby did the same thing and got a codicil into the Appropriations Act that said that the Department of Agriculture was forbidden from making a rule about how many times potatoes could be served during a week, at a time when the Department of Agriculture was trying to encourage schools to expose kids to different kinds of vegetables, which seemed to me to be a really good idea.
Leslie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Just listening in, I'm a substitute teacher in various districts around the Columbus area, and also have also taught chemistry a couple years at a local private school. And one of the things that I incorporated in the curriculum was a community garden.
Oh, and good for you.
Well, thank you. And it was encouraged by the staff, but I really enjoy it because I do a little bit of gardening, have done it for the past few years. Not at all a master gardener, but, you know, not only did the community garden serve as encouraging healthier eating, but it was a community involvement where we gave some of the vegetables away. I incorporated into the science curriculum, so we learned about some of the science behind gardening. And I know that some, you know, quite a few schools do incorporate school gardens and where the students are responsible for tending to it. And I was just wondering if that's something that could, from the political end, is that something that could be encouraged in various districts, you know, even though they may not have the land space to do it, but you can also do container gardening. And when children see the fruits of their labor, you know, they would maybe become more interested in gardening and more healthier eating alternatives.
Yeah, our connection with food is a plays something of a role, doesn't it, Mary Nessel?
Oh, it's an enormous connection, and the caller is absolutely right. Schools that have incorporated gardens and are teaching kids how to grow food and where food comes from find that the kids are just fascinated by it and are willing to taste foods that they grew when they would never taste them under any other circumstances. And there are city schools in New York where I live that have no land whatsoever, but the schools have put in some raised beds and some containers, and the kids are just having a wonderful time with it. And I think every school could find some place to do that, and it would be great, greatly to the advantage of the kids, and also would greatly promote interest in the school lunch program and make the whole program go much more easily. So it's a terrific thing to do, and there are thousands of schools in America now that have garden programs associated with them.
Leslie, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. And Dr. Marian Nessel, thanks to you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dr. Marian Nessel, she's a New York University professor of nutrition, food politics, and public health, and the author of the book Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. We'll continue our conversation about food policy in the United States. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about food policy in the United States, how it comes about, and now turning the conversation to the debate over food labeling. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is the Managing Director of Food Policy Action. That's a consumer advocacy group that focuses on food policy in the United States. Claire Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone from Arlington, Massachusetts, is Tufts University professor in the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and the author of the book Food Policy in the United States, Dr. Park Wilde. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Let's start with the issue of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. A GMO has some genetic material altered by scientists to produce a desirable trait, for instance, tomatoes that stay fresh longer. Claire, let's start with you. Why are GMOs an issue? Why is that bad?
I'm not sure that it's fair to say that GMOs are bad. Mm-hmm. I think what's important here to recognize is that consumers want to know more now than ever what's in their food. 93% of Americans support labeling GE food. 64 nations require food, including Russia, China, Saudi Arabia. We're really just behind the curve on this.
What is the curve, Dr. Park Wilde, on this? When did it start to enter our consciousness that this was an issue?
Right. Well, I think the genetically modified organisms have been controversial from the beginning, but it's been heating up more and more as advocates have had some success with mandatory labeling proposals at the state level.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent are our foods genetically modified as it is, Claire Benjamin?
Well, that's part of the problem. We just don't know how many products in every grocery store are genetically modified. We know that corn and soybeans obviously do have genetically modified seeds, but there is no label nationally in stores. So consumers who want to have that consciousness and want to know what they're feeding their kids have no way to do that right now.
So because there's no label, that means there's no reporting at all?
That's correct.
Dr. Park Wilde, what kind of policies are out there now? Does the government control any of the GMO production?
The government does a couple things. It overviews food safety for both GMOs and conventional food, and it reviews things like risk of having crops that are being tested released into the environment or spreading to natural relatives of the crops involved.
And Claire Benjamin, what besides labeling, is there anything beyond that, or do you just think that it's about knowledge?
For us, we think consumers have the right to know. Consumers, by and large, really want to know what's in their food, and we think that should be the central issue. Consumers want to know, and we should give them that right.
So what has been the holdup? If you're saying 64 nations already do it, 93% of the Americans support it, who are the players in the issue of, or the fight for and against genetically modified organisms being labeled, at least, as in our food? Dr. Park Wilde? Sure. Or Claire, yeah. Go ahead. Claire Benjamin?
Well, take Vermont, for example. Vermont was the third state in the nation to pass labeling laws on a state level earlier this year. That law would take 2 years to go into effect. It was passed overwhelmingly in the legislature there. And just this week, the Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto, two of the largest players in this debate, have filed a lawsuit against Vermont saying that labeling in this way of genetically modified food is not legal.
How not legal?
They're saying that putting the burden on that state and having foods labeled in just one state is not would not be acceptable for commerce.
So then, what at the federal level? What's going on?
There is a bill in the House and the Senate introduced by Barbara Boxer and Peter DeFazio to have mandatory labeling for genetically modified foods. And while that has gotten some support, it's been predominantly a partisan issue so far, unfortunately. And then the counter bill to that has been introduced by a congressman from Kansas, Mike Pompeo, who introduced a bill that would actually not allow the FDA to pass labeling laws, to say that they would not be permitted, that the FDA's current stance on genetically modified foods, which is that they don't need to be labeled, they cause, you know, they have no risk, should continue. And would actually preempt states from being able to pass labeling laws as well.
Dr. Park Wilde, Monsanto's huge. It's international. Aren't they already labeling foods in other countries then, if 64 other nations require it?
Right. So you can tell that this has gotten to be a very controversial topic in the United States, and it's gotten tied up with a lot of our big national divisions between, you know, liberals and conservatives, and between kind of food system traditionalists and critics of the contemporary food system. There's a lot of things people worry about with these GMOs. They worry about its connection to kind of high input, highly industrialized agriculture. People are worried about allergies. People are worried about monopoly control of the seed industry. In particular, Monsanto has very high shares of the seed business for both corn and soybeans. And I think people are also concerned about kind of overhyping new technology as a way of solving our big problems. So you might be wondering, why doesn't everybody support labeling? In a way, that's what you're asking. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is because our food safety authorities aren't well equipped for dealing with all those issues at once. They have one main question that they're tasked with asking, which is, do GMOs seem to be unsafe? And the answer for most of the scientific community is no. There's not a lot of evidence that GMOs are any different in their safety from the corresponding conventional foods. That doesn't mean that any food is perfectly safe. You know, you think about allergies that come from mushrooms or peanuts or milk or gluten or mm-hmm. any number of other things, but that by and large, that GMOs are similar to the conventional food that they're related to. And because the food safety authorities are only really allowed by law to look at food safety in particular, they have a hard time vetting kind of these broader mm-hmm. cultural arguments.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about food labeling, whether or not it should be, what are the ramifications if it is and isn't. My guests are Park Wilde. He's a professor at Tufts University, where he teaches nutrition and nutrition science and policy. He's also the author of the book Food Policy in the United States. Also with us, Claire Benjamin. She's managing director of Food Policy Action. That's a consumer advocacy group that focuses on food policy in the United States. It should be noted that we did reach out to many food industry organizations for this show, including the Grocery Manufacturers Association and others. We did not receive any response at all. If you have a question or comment, you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Claire Benjamin, what about those larger societal issues that we're talking about? For instance, this issue of seeds and the lack of diversity in seeds going forward into the future, because proponents of GMOs will say they're concerned about how we're going to feed the world in the future, and GMOs are part of that larger strategy to grow more food for the future. On the other side of the coin, people are worried about the lack of diversity in the seeds in our culture now.
Sorry, I think it's important to distinguish here that we aren't making an assault on the science. We aren't actually saying that these are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And in our organization, we're actually not even really having this discussion about seed diversity. We feel strongly the public really wants to know what's in their food. We label things like fat and saturated fat and calories. And so, you know, this idea that only things that are safe or dangerous need to be labeled. Well, if they were dangerous, they wouldn't be on the market. We label all sorts of things on food because the consumer has that right to know. And so that's really all we're asking for.
Do you agree with Park Wilde's assertion that there's a problem because the food safety people in the federal government kind of have their hands tied? It's not really in their bailiwick?
I think there's a real disconnect with the leadership at the FDA and what consumers want. You know, they are in many cases not representing the public in this debate, but really representing these large corporate interests who think that they have a lot to lose if consumers start to really see where the GMOs are in different food products.
So Park Wilde, can we talk about the issue of the relationship between GMOs and seed diversity and that sort of thing going forward into the future? What does a GMO have to do with seeds and the availability of seeds?
Right. So the companies that sell the genetically modified seeds have innovated in a number of ways. They often patent their technology so that they can essentially earn kind of a fee or a property, the value of their intellectual property when they sell seed to farmers. They're limited in what they can charge farmers by how much the change in the seed is worth it to the farmer, whether the additional features have any value to the farmer. But it means that they can be the sole seller. And so this control of the seeds is one of the things that people worry about with GMOs. One of my misgivings about GMO labeling is that the label just distinguishes whether a food is a GMO or is not a GMO, but it doesn't distinguish within either of those groups. So, for example, if you had genetically modified organisms where the technology was in the public domain because it had been supported by a government extension agency, that would still be labeled GMO, even though it wouldn't have this concern about corporate control of the seed industry. And on the other hand, some of the particular crops, those concerns about what's our industrial organization here are more serious.
So, all right. So, Claire Benjamin, say my food is labeled GMO. What does that really tell me? What would I do with that information anyway, since it doesn't distinguish in that way?
You mean that it doesn't distinguish currently?
Right. In the nations where they do require GMO labeling, what do consumers really get for that? Just a stamp of this is GMO, this is genetically modified and that's it. But I don't know why. I don't know in what way.
Yeah, it's similar to any food label that you're going to see. And it's different in each country. But the sort of what it looks like, I think, is less important than actually having it. What we're really hoping for is the ability to look at a food and say that it's not genetically modified. So take a strawberry, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There are currently no genetically modified strawberries, but you see a strawberry in a grocery store, and one says organic, and one says conventional. But the consumer has no idea which is or isn't genetically modified. So in a labeling system, they would both be labeled GMO-free. What is sort of not understood that well right now is that the only food on the market that is GMO-free is organic food. So if it has the USDA seal on it, mm-hmm. it has not been – no GMOs were used in that product. But they use the organic seal. They don't use a GMO-free seal.
But if it doesn't say organic, does it mean that it is GMO-modified?
No, and that's part of the problem. Consumers, there's just so much confusion in the marketplace, and consumers have no way to get that information.
Vermont passed GMO labeling guidelines, I think, this month or last month, and several counties in Oregon have voted to keep GMO farming out of their borders. Okay, looks like we've lost somebody. Why don't we take a quick break? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about food policy in the United States, specifically labeling of our food. Still with us is Claire Benjamin. She's managing director of the consumer advocacy group Food Policy Action. Also with us is Dr. Park Wilde. He's a professor at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University and author of the book Food Policy in the United States. It should be noted that we reached out to many food industry organizations for this show. We received no response. If you have a question or comment, you are welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Listeners, would you like to have your food labeled GMO or non-GMO? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. As I was saying before we took that quick break, Vermont passed GMO labeling guidelines recently. Several counties in Oregon have voted to keep GMO farming out of their borders. Park Wilde, what are the prospects for this as a trend? How realistic is it to stop GMO farming at a border?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I'm kind of bad at forecasting some of these things. even having followed food policy for 20 years, I always get surprised from time to time. On this one, I would guess that it's going to be difficult to really end the adoption of GMO technologies. Whether there's going to be a label, that seems more possible to me.
And what do you think a label should say?
For me, I think that the GMO, non-GMO label is, it can be just very straightforward. In other words, if that's what consumers want and if legislators support it. But for me, it's never going to be the part of the label that interests me most. In other words, for both the environmental issues I care about, food safety issues, food quality issues, interest in what type of farmer produced the food, for none of those things does the GMO label speak to me in particular.
Yeah, like I'd kind of want to know, I guess, if it's been modified so that the strawberry is red-looking. There's all different ways they can modify these things. Now, it's not. Would there be any interest in knowing why and how it was modified?
Right. In fact, you think about how industrialization changes foods, and a lot of the methods that are used aren't GMO in particular. So, for example, new hybrid varieties connected with the Green Revolution both allow us to feed the world better, but also raise substantial environmental concerns about how much chemicals or nitrogen are applied to the food. And those are the concerns that are with us, but all of that is non-GMO technology. Or you think about how genetic science is used to select particular breeds of a crop that are more likely to thrive. You know, they inspect the genome to see what its qualities are likely to be and to plant only the ones that work well. That, too, that doesn't count as a GMO technology.
Claire Benjamin, critics of mandatory labeling have argued that there's no reliable evidence that GMOs are harmful and that labeling them as GMO or not unfairly implies that there is reason for concern.
You know, again, we label how much fat is in a food, we label how many calories, we label all sorts of things on the back of the label of all food. And I would just sort of reiterate, if the food were dangerous, we wouldn't have it on the market. So that really isn't the insinuation. The answer here is that people want to know what is in their food, and a GMO label speaks to, you know, the seed in which it was grown from, and it to the other your other points about coloring or additives.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't. That's not what GMO labeling is about. It's not what GMOs are about. It's really about the seed in which it was derived from.
And Park Wilde, were you trying to say something?
Oh, no. In fact, that sounds exactly right to me.
Okay. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
I just wanted to say that, you know, the whole thing about organic versus, U.S. Things that are labeled organic. Michael Pollan talked about this in his second book, that when it comes to buying something that's labeled organic, you really need to look at the what country it's coming from, because then you have to weigh how many air miles the food is going from. So, like, a lot of them are labeled Peru, Chile. Mm-hmm. I find it completely absurd that kiwis are growing from Italy, of all places. And there's no easy solution. But he suggests that if it's a choice between something that's labeled organic that comes from another country that's spent that much, you know, making even a bigger imprint on our planet from using all that gas that comes in an airline to bring it to you,
mm-hmm.
And something that's considered conventional, it just, you know, there's no easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and it gets even stickier when you live in the Midwest, because we don't have the ability to grow organic fruits and vegetables year-round like on the West Coast, and it's not as inexpensive. So it's just murky waters, and I think it's something that people aren't always aware of. And I've had to make the choice, it's just
mm-hmm.
pick your battles.
Yeah.
And with strawberries and grapes, there's so many pesticides that are grown on them. I choose not to buy grapes or strawberries that aren't labeled organic, because I think it's Cesar Chavez and the workers.
Hmm.
So that's all I have to say.
All right, Beth. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
You know, Park Wilde, listening to Beth and other folks, it makes you wonder, when you ratchet all of this out, how much the average consumer really is better off anymore nowadays. As she said, there's no easy answer. The more information you have, the more confusing it can be.
Right. You think about the issues of concern to the last caller, all of which are fascinating. Interested about GMO-free foods, interested about organic foods, which have low use of artificial chemicals, interested in local food, locally sourced food, and interested in fairness to the workers. And so for a consumer who wants to educate him or herself, there's a lot to pay attention to beyond any one particular part of the label. But on the other hand, not everybody wants to pay attention to all of that. It's kind of beyond some folks' bandwidth. And so for, I think, people who don't want to be reading every part of the label, they sort of rely on the brand identity of some of the places where they get their food. Maybe they go to a CSA and they just eat whatever the farmer provides them. Or maybe they trust one of the retailer brands like Whole Foods or a particular retail brand that they think reflects their values.
Claire Benjamin, how can you respond to that too? Just how plugged in people are? Are they almost too plugged in? Is there too much information? How do we sift through all of this?
Yeah, it's an incredibly complicated landscape when you're looking at all of the different options and all of the different labels on food. And I think, you know, what we're seeing, especially in the last 10 years, is in many parts of the country, the average age of farmers is going down while the number of acres in cultivation is going up. The number of farmers markets and CSAs and farm-to-table establishments all across the country are on the rise. And that, I think, directly relates to this question of people wanting to just have more information about where their food comes from. They want to look their farmer in the eye. There's been this huge resurgence back to the land and, wanting to just have that information about your food.
But we know that if we relied purely on locally produced food, we would starve to death nowadays, because there just isn't enough being grown, and they can't grow enough locally year-round.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that is a problem with the laws coming out of Washington, and that you know, not enough funding and emphasis is being put on growing back our local infrastructure, whether it be local processing or canning or farmers markets. But you're right, we do not produce enough food to feed people locally. But there has been tremendous growth, and I think you'll just see more and more of that in the coming years.
Stan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Stan.
Hi. My question is, this whole fear of GMOs, isn't it also a lot of the fear of the modern world? Because like corn, centuries ago it was a grass, but people over the centuries modified it until today. It needs human beings to plant it. I was wondering the person you have thinks of that.
Park Wilde?
Right. So, you know, I tend to agree with the caller. And I say that even though I'm very sympathetic to the advocates working in this area. So I'm kind of interested to hear Claire's comment on this one.
Claire.
I'm not sure I would completely agree that there's a fear of the modern world, although I appreciate the caller's comments. I think more than anything that this is the regulatory system sort of failing to catch up with what the public wants more than almost anything.
Park Wilde, you mentioned earlier, and we talked about the fact that the agencies that regulate food in the United States regulate food safety. And as long as something like GMOs aren't particularly dangerous that we know of yet or now, they can't. So should there be another agency? Is there another role out there to be played by another agency or a new agency?
Right. It's just because of that issue that this needs this needs action by Congress to happen. It just can't happen as a regulatory initiative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about everybody's diverse opinions on this. You've got people who are really scared of GMOs, and you've got people who are sure that they're 100% safe. It's almost as if they were, like, sent down by angels or something. And there's a lot of people in the middle, and I think Claire and Food Policy Action are in this category where they're really not fear-mongering. They're just saying that if people are curious about it, they ought to have it on the label.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm not necessarily going to persuade folks on this, but to me, I feel like there really ought to be a substantial concern to government scientists before the government makes a new label mandatory. That it's one thing to have the companies do things optionally in order to meet what consumers are curious about, mm-hmm. but it's another thing to write a rule that says everybody has to put this label on. You know, this affects both small businesses and large, and I guess that's personally why I'm not out in the reef on this particular issue.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I just feel that these chemical companies are trying to make money, that they search around for ways to make money. They don't search around for ways to improve the world. And there's only so many things you can do with a chemical company. Putting herbicides in food is not good for anybody. These GMOs are bad for your health.
You mean in the case of GMOs that modify a plant's resistance to weeds or insects,
right,
or something like
that? They're making Roundup Ready corn and wheat. That Roundup is a herbicide. It's highly toxic. I don't see how putting that into a corn or wheat is going to help anybody. We need less herbicides. There's a big problem with atrazine in Ohio, washing off crops. There's a whole series of conferences with farmers getting them to use less atrazine by the Federal Soil Conservation Service. So I think we need rational policies on food rather than corporate policies. And America is all about making money, and they just lobby and they just make corporate decisions.
It's that darn capitalism, but Park Wilde,
sure.
Talk about some of these GMOs, and David, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Are there things like that out there that could be dangerous and we just don't know yet? The tests aren't in, or what?
So it's possible on the GMOs in particular, but for David is a classic person for whom the organic label is designed because he expresses concern about GMOs, which are not allowed on the organic certified foods, but he also expresses concerns about herbicides, which are allowed on non-GMO food, that if you really want to avoid both GMOs and artificial herbicides, he mentioned atrazine, mm-hmm. and he also mentioned glyphosate, really the organic label's for you.
Isn't it a larger societal question, though? Not just what we ingest personally, but what we're putting into the environment. There's a huge problem with runoff and algae blooms in Ohio, at least. And I know it's across the country. It's a problem as well. Isn't there more to it than that?
Yeah. So those are some of the environmental issues that concern me most. If I had to list what environmental issues connected with the food system cause me to lose sleep at night, one of them is climate change. And one of them is these runoff down our waterways leading to the ocean,
right.
Especially because of nitrogen fertilizer.
All the way down to the Everglades.
Right. But those aren't going to be addressed exactly by the GMO label. I think that requires both national rules on the externalities that agriculture imposes on the environment, but also regional efforts, in particular watersheds, like the Mississippi watershed and the Chesapeake Bay watershed, where people are working very hard to reduce what ends up in the waterways.
So, Clara, Benjamin, I'll ask you, maybe I've already asked it in another way, but just what would you change about how the government's operating now to address these kinds of issues if they're focused on food safety per se and not on knowledge, because that's what their job is, how would you change that?
So to be clear, the Food and Drug Administration absolutely has the authority and the skill set to produce labels. And I just want to quickly talk about the chemical companies and the herbicides, if I can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when chemical companies first introduced GE crops about 20 years ago, advocates told us that GE crops would help reduce herbicides. But the fact is that it has increased herbicide use, by 530 million pounds between 1996 and 2011. This is of serious concern, and it should be of concern to the whole public, not just people who want to buy or, you know, organic. That isn't always an available option for all consumers. And so these are public health issues. This is, I think, a great reason, maybe one of the top reasons for labeling, so the consumer can make that choice when they're at the grocery store.
Park Wilde, how has GMO use increased the use of herbicides?
I think Claire's right. It's probably increased the use of glyphosate in particular. But I think that even with that increase of a particular herbicide in mind, I think of herbicides and GMOs as really two fairly separate issues, that the concern about herbicides in general is something way beyond what the number of consumers who are going to choose the non-GMO label can address through their voluntary action in the grocery store aisles. It doesn't solve everything that one would hope, and it maybe has effects that aren't part of what somebody intended to if your goal is to reduce herbicide use.
What's the cause and effect between GMOs and herbicides?
Well, I think Claire might have mentioned that one of the leading GMO technologies, you know, the GMO proponents will promise you all kinds of technologies. It'll have to do with, like, vitamin crops, and it'll have to do with saving farmers in dry areas of
mm-hmm.
East Africa. But the leading applications that are currently on the market in the U.S. have to do with, for example, a crop that's resistant to herbicide, allowing the farmers
okay.
to apply more of that herbicide in their field.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you. Of course, this is an ongoing conversation. Won't solve anything today, won't end anything, won't start anything. But we appreciate your conversation, your participation today. Dr. Park Wilde, thanks.
Great to talk to you both.
Dr. Park Wilde, he's a professor at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. He's also the author of the book Food Policy in the United States. And Claire Benjamin, thanks as well to you.
Thank you, Ann.
Claire Benjamin is the Managing Director of Food Policy Action. That's a consumer advocacy group that focuses on food policy in the United States. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.